The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of December 3rd, 2018. On this week's show, Lindsey Gibbs of Think Progress and the Burn It All Down podcast will join us to discuss the Kansas City Chiefs' decision to cut star running back Kareem Hunt after TMZ released a video of Hunt pushing and kicking a woman. The New York Times' Mark Tracy will also be here to talk about Alabama's crazy come-from-behind win over Georgia in the SEC title game, where they were led by one-time starter and now backup quarterback Jalen Hurts. And Grant Wall of Sports Illustrated will tell us what we need to know about the U.S. men's national soccer team's new head coach Greg Berhalter, as well as the tortured process that led to Berhalter's hiring. Joining me in our Washington, D.C. studio is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hey, Josh.
Stefan, should we talk about our holiday plans?
We could do that.
Yeah.
Or first, should we talk about the fact that the Seattle Seahawks had a scorigami again over the weekend?
Scorigamied, I think is
they
the verb.
They scorigamied over the weekend, 43-16.
I was surprised that that was a scorigami.
Extending Pete Carroll's streak of scorigamis to 9 seasons.
9 seasons in a row?
He's the Cal Ripken of scorigami.
That's amazing.
That is kind of crazy.
Congratulations.
Two listeners pointed that out to me on Twitter.
It's good that you have a reputation.
I have a brand.
So holiday plans, back to that. So we haven't done a call-in show for a while. We're going to do another one for either our Christmas or New Year's show. We haven't discussed it. We'll figure it out. But one of those. And I don't think we should put any sort of parameters on the questions. Conundrums are great. If you want to ask us a question about playing basketball underwater, that's cool. If you would just want to ask us anything else random, that's fine too. As long as it's a good and fun question to answer on a sports podcast.
There'd be a lot of dunking in basketball underwater. Be kind of hard to score otherwise, don't you think?
Depends on if you weight the basketball, but perhaps we don't want to give away the milk for free here, Stefan.
True.
Okay, so the phone number is 77-HANG-UP-10, and you should call us and ask your question. Preferably do it on a phone line that does not sound like you're playing basketball underwater. Ask us anything that you want us to answer. We want calls from men and from women, and we want them on topics that are reasonably evergreen, so ones that we can answer in a couple of weeks. Again, the phone number is 77-HANG-UP-10. We look forward to your calls.
How heavy do you think the basketball would have to be underwater? There's got to be a weight where the basketball won't float at all.
If we have any physicists out there who want to answer that question, I feel like I'm not really prepared to answer that one off the cuff.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On Friday afternoon, the website TMZ, which in 2014 had been the first to publish the video of the Baltimore Ravens' Ray Rice dragging his then fiance out of an elevator unconscious, released footage of Kansas City Chiefs running back Kareem Hunt shoving and then kicking a woman outside his apartment in a Cleveland hotel. Later in the day, the Chiefs released the 23-year-old Hunt, saying that he lied to the team about the incident. Joining us now in our D.C. studio is Lindsey Gibbs of Think Progress. She's also one of the hosts of the podcast Burn It All Down. Hey, Lindsey, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Lindsey, the fact that Hunt was involved in, quote, off-season incidents, plural, and I hate to use the word incident, but sometimes no other word yeah. fits. The fact that he was involved in these incidents has been known for a while. Can you explain the timeline here? So this scene that we saw depicted in the video happened in February, right?
Yeah, it happened in February. And at the time, it was known that there was a fight with a woman that he had presumably just met that night, you know, not an ongoing relationship. The police report and the reporting from Cleveland reporters did say that he had pushed and shoved her. There was no mention of a kick, but it pretty quickly faded into the background. He was also in trouble for another incident a few months later where he had punched a man at while he was out, I believe, at a bar. And so it was kind of all wrapped into off-field character issues. During training camp, the Chiefs talked about how they were really investing in him as a man and trying to teach him to be a better person. But the domestic violence and the assault of a woman pretty much faded into the background until this video came out.
It's kind of remarkable that it did fade into the background and that the Chiefs and the NFL both decided to let it fade into the background. The NFL has tremendous latitude to punish, and it has done that in the past. I mean, Ezekiel Elliott got suspended for 6 games. There was no video. Josh Brown of the New York Giants initially was suspended for 1 game before the league was hit with a lot of outrage and extended that suspension further. So clearly there were decisions made, choices made by the league, and ultimately that is what is just makes the league look so terrible. Let's stipulate that domestic violence of any sort is outrageous and that Kareem Hunt should be excoriated and should be suspended. There should be some action taken against him. But the process by which this wasn't addressed or the way it was addressed is what's really troubling for the NFL here.
It's absolutely staggering. I mean, the fact that it seems that everyone knew that there was a camera recording this at this hotel, and the NFL apparently asked for it, was told they couldn't have it. The Cleveland Police Department, which this is really staggering to me, didn't even go after it because it was a misdemeanor and not a felony, and they don't get videos for misdemeanors, which is just mind-boggling. And so this video has just been out there. The Chiefs apparently were told to stop looking for it because the NFL was looking for it. Furthermore, the NFL never talked to Kareem Hunt himself because they said the Chiefs talked to him. Since the Chiefs talked to him, that was fine. That was enough information. So there were so many missteps along the way. And every time this comes up with the NFL and with teams, there are missteps. There are wrongdoings. Nobody can get this right to a degree that is baffling.
I think it's easier, at least for me, to understand where the NFL went wrong here than what the actual right process would have been or should be, because Amy Trask was on CBS, did a segment on their NFL pregame show, and a segment that was very widely praised, like Amy Trask should be the commissioner. Yeah. Amy Trask
former Oakland Raiders president, right?
Yeah, and talking about what she would have done if she were the team president of the Chiefs and how she would have proceeded. And she said a thing that teams need to think about doing now is pursuing these videos in the way that TMZ does. She didn't say it explicitly, but my sense of what she was saying is like, maybe try to pay someone who works at the hotel to get it, like go through some back door, like the way that a tabloid publication should. And I found that like actually extremely troubling. The idea that teams should be going out and engaging in behavior that we would expect from the likes of a TMZ and trying to get somebody to give them a video kind of out the back door or something. Well, I see this as like a failure of the criminal justice system. As Lindsay said, the Cleveland police not getting this video. I see it as a failure of, as you said, the NFL being like, oh, we don't need to talk to Kareem Hunt because the Chiefs did, but oh, the Chiefs don't need to look for the video because the NFL did. Like, there's an extreme lack of coherence there. But I don't know if I actually blame the NFL for not getting this video.
Well, except that you're assuming that the only way to get the video is to pay an employee of the hotel who may have access to it. The NFL, let's not forget, employs former cops, former FBI agents. They have they created a panel on domestic violence headed by a former prosecutor. It's not as if there are lots of ways to get information in society without having to pay for it. That's what law enforcement, that's what private investigators do every day. And the NFL is armed with private investigators.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I believed the NFL when they said they tried to get the video from the hotel and weren't able to get it.
Yeah, I don't think that – do you think that the NFL, Lindsay, actually didn't want to see if there were video or see the video once they knew there was video?
I think that they believed Kareem Hunt and didn't think that there was anything on the video, and that's what's really bothersome to me. I mean, these teams have private security that they hire to watch their most troubled players, right? These teams pay for so much stuff to babysit some of these players and to make sure that they stay safe and are, you know, taking care of the money of the team and everything like that. That honestly, I know what you're saying, Josh, but paying for a video, paying a little under the table money for a video that might shine some light on an incident isn't that appalling of a notion.
I mean, the NFL spent how many million dollars investigating whether Tom Brady, you know, whether a Tom Brady flunky lets him air out of a football.
Well, that's definitely true. there's not an argument there that the NFL took Deflategate more seriously than they took this. But I guess another way to look at it is the behavior that you guys seem to be endorsing here that you would want the NFL to undertake, I feel like you would think was troubling in other contexts where a private employer would take it upon itself to act as this extrajudicial arm.
Oh, I'm not suggesting that they should. I'm suggesting that it's within their power and ability, and it shouldn't surprise anybody if an organization like the NFL did operate that way when it came to security and investigations. I think the bigger issue is the way the NFL and its executives think. I mean, go back to August during training camp when the CEO of the Kansas City Chiefs, Clark Hunt, who knew that there were issues with Kareem Hunt, no relation. And he stood up in front of the media and basically made the argument that boys will be boys. He's young. We're working with him. There's been some stuff. You know, quote, they're not always going to make the best decisions, but we have a strong support system, both with the coaching staff and also with our player development department that works with young guys and talks to them about the situation they want to be in. Young guys, young men, you know, it doesn't really give them much agency for being mature adults who are, in addition to being paid very well, like Kareem Hunt is, unlike other players in the NFL. I mean, this is a future superstar, a current superstar, who's going to make money. And to sort of have that paternalistic approach toward your employees is very reflective of how the NFL operates.
And let's not forget that the biggest problem here is that nobody seems to care unless there is a video, which is why we're talking so much about the video and why the procurement of the video isn't where I can really get outraged, because why don't we care when we hear about it in reports? Like, why isn't it real until there's a surveillance video or, in Greg Hardy's case, you know, these photographs?
Or in Reuben Foster's case.
Right.
An arrest, two, three.
Just last week, before the Kareem Hunt video came out, I wrote a piece called NFL Groundhog Day, which was about the way the NFL had mishandled domestic violence allegation after domestic violence allegation in the 4 years since Ray Rice. That was about the Reuben Foster situation. And now here we are, just 2 days later. And remind you, this was one day before the six-year anniversary of when Javon Belcher, who was with the Kansas City Chiefs, murdered his pregnant girlfriend, Cassandra Perkins, and then, of course, committed suicide in the parking lot. So this has been an ongoing problem, and the Kansas City Chiefs have dealt with this more than anyone. And the organization still, as you just mentioned, they continue to make excuses. They continue to say this boys will be boys mentality.
So I think in general, that is exactly correct. I think there's one kind of complicating factor in this case, which is that, as you mentioned, the police report didn't mention that he kicked the woman. And as Lisa Salter said in her interview with Hunt, that was the moment in the video that actually stood out. Let's listen to Salter's and then Hunt's response.
When I watched the videos, the lasting impression for me was the kick. You kicking a woman while she was on the ground. You kicking a woman, period. How do you explain that?
You can't really explain it. The video shows it. I was in the wrong, and I'm not that type of person. I'm really disappointed and embarrassed for myself and for my family, and I really am taking actions to learn from this and do everything possible to, you know, become a better man.
sort of echoing the comments that Clark Hunt made, right? He's repeating back what's been told to him, right, Stefan?
I think so. And maybe he's sincere. Maybe Kareem Hunt has learned from this. Maybe he did make a mistake. And he's entitled to getting counseling and rehabilitating himself and his reputation and his behavior and performing some sort of restitution to achieve that. That's almost beside the point here. The point is, when the NFL and the Kansas City Chiefs found out that, you know, I'm not sure that the kicking isn't also sort of parsing this too far. The police report, the 911 call, the woman said, he shoved me, he pushed me, he took my phone, he has my phone. I'm not sure we need much more. You know, these investigators can get more details.
If the NFL system was working the way it seemed to be set out to work, with this no tolerance, 6 games minimum, a few mitigating circumstances that can go less than 6 games, which is the system that was set out after Ray Rice, then presumably Kareem Hunt would have already been punished, would have already been dealt with this, and we could have been moving on. I think where the outrage comes is it feels like the NFL and the Chiefs and everyone are trying to cover this stuff up, are trying to push it under the rug. And that's, to me, the worst part. It doesn't do it, to use a general term, the alleged abusers, or in this case, you know, we've seen a video, any favors either. You know, if he had already been punished, had already been put through some sort of system, had already been given a chance to start the rehabilitation process and to take ownership for what he's done, then he doesn't become this TMZ national outrage Ray Rice redux person.
The problem, of course, is that from the NFL's perspective is that they have failed in almost every attempt to impose these punishments.
Right.
They're going to end up in court. It's going to get reversed. It's happened over and over again. And Roger Goodell, the commissioner, has looked like an impotent ruler.
Yeah, I mean, what happens if they punish him based on this report with no video and Hunt apparently lied about what happened? So it's his word against this woman's word. Maybe the league is saying, oh, well, we don't want to have to go to court and look like idiots again. I think the issue that you guys have identified that's correct is just the seeming lack of interest.
Yeah.
And finding out, you know, it's obviously different being suspended from your workplace versus like being sent to prison. But there wasn't like clear and unambiguous evidence before this video came out. It wasn't like Kareem Hunt admitted to what he had done. And that, I think, is also interesting that like you get the likes of Tony Dungy, the like football man, like head coach type, who says the real problem here isn't what Kareem Hunt did, it's that he lied. And that's why that's why I would never have him on my team again, because he like looked at the coach and he lied. Like, that is the real NFL mentality.
That's very true. And that's the most disturbing. And even Kareem Hunt himself, when he was talking about seeing the video, he said, I didn't realize how bad it was until I saw the video. I didn't realize what I'd done until I saw the video. And then he kept saying, that's not me. I'm not that man. It's this distancing from the actions that everyone seems to be comfortable with. And that's a continuous problem in the NFL. It's a continuous problem in society. And let's not forget that the reason this is such a big deal, the reason why we need to be able to figure this out, is because 20 people per minute are physically abused by an intimate partner. You know, 1 in 4 women have been victims of severe physical violence, and more than half of female homicide victims are killed in connection with inter partner violence. And I just like to continue to bring up those statistics to say, like, the reason this needs to be taken seriously is because it's not being, and because at some point somebody has to stop this cycle. And the NFL said it was going to get its house in order, and it hasn't.
So the Chiefs also have Tyreek Hill on their roster, who choked his pregnant girlfriend when he was in college at Oklahoma State. The Chiefs drafted him with, I believe, full knowledge of that incident. Sam Mellinger wrote a column for the Kansas City paper. This was in connection to Luke Heimlich, which we've also talked about, and the idea that the Royals should or should not give Luke Heimlich a chance. He had confessed to molesting his young relative, and there was a big debate about that. And Mellinger said, I've actually changed my mind on Hill because I think this is a guy who's gotten his life in order, and I'm glad that the Chiefs gave him a chance. Now, how a newspaper columnist can have the confidence that that is correct. I have no idea. But the point here is that there seems to be this philosophy that Ray Rice, Kareem Hunt, whoever, the team that currently employs that player, it seems like there is now the feeling that, okay, we have to cut that player. But if they did it like 5 minutes before they were employed by us, or like 6 months or 2 years, then it's fine. Like, that was the disturbing thing about the Reuben Foster situation. Not that he was given another chance. That doesn't bother me. It's the idea that he was he was arrested for domestic abuse, and it seemed like within like a day, Washington signed him. So that I think was the troubling part. Not the fact. And if Kareem Hunt gets another chance with a team down the road, I don't think that's a problem.
Yeah, I'm all for second chances and, you know, letting people go through this process. I thought Kareem Hunt, I think a lot of people thought he didn't do himself any favors. In the Lisa Salters interview, he didn't seem incredibly contrite or upset. I was glad he didn't make excuses. My bar might be very low, but
I think there should be a low bar. I mean, he's not like somebody who's, a professional speaker.
Right.
Like we shouldn't judge him like he is.
No, I know. And I thought it was a live interview, which I thought was a good thing by ESPN's call. Lisa Salters was the right person. It was completely the opposite of the redemption narrative they gave Greg Hardy. I don't know if you remember a few years ago, where Adam Schefter, it was this, you know, showy interview with Greg Hardy about how much he had changed, and it was edited and all the stuff in post-production, whereas this was a live 11-minute one-on-one interview between Lisa Salters and Kareem Hunt. So I thought that was the right way to do it if you're going to do that. But I agree. It's just so hard to know when accountability comes in.
Whether you like it or not, this comes down to the athlete's ability. Josh Brown, the kicker for the Giants, was expendable because there are a lot of kickers that can do what he could do. Reuben Foster is really a middling linebacker by ratings at this point, so that's why the Washington team's decision to immediately sign him seemed so ridiculous. Kareem Hunt has a potential, you know, based on his first couple of years in the league, to put up huge.
Well, he already
numbers.
Is a great player.
And
everyone who said, and rightly so, that we shouldn't congratulate the Chiefs for cutting him, I think that's a totally fair point. I also think we would be remiss not to recognize the fact that this wouldn't have happened maybe before Ray Rice, a team cutting a star player who's like under team control on like a really good contract and a team that is one of the favorites to make the Super Bowl. Like, I'm not saying we should congratulate the Chiefs. I'm saying we should recognize the fact, and I don't even know if you want to call it progress, it's just different. Like, that would never have happened a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's slight change. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't say we're talking about talent and a talent always wins out, except, of course, in the case of Colin Kaepernick, which is hanging over all of this stuff. And I think did make the Reuben Foster decision by the Washington NFL team that much more egregious because they could probably use a quarterback.
Lindsay Gibbs writes for Think Progress. You can also check her out on the great podcast Burn It All Down. Lindsay, thank you so much for being here.
It was a pleasure.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we get to college football, I wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we are going to talk to a real-life, genuine Alabama fan. Our colleague Molly Olmsted of Slate will tell us what it's like to root for a team that never loses. To hear that conversation, join Slate Plus. It's just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. In college football's national championship game in January, Alabama fell behind Georgia 20-7 in the second half before backup quarterback Tua Tagovailoa, who had come in relief of starter Jalen Hurts, led the Crimson Tide to a stunning 26-23 overtime victory. On Saturday in Atlanta, Alabama executed the exact same comeback with the exact same quarterbacks against the exact same opponent, except those quarterbacks took on exact opposite roles. This time, the Tide were down 28-21 when Hurts came on in relief of an injured Tagovailoa, throwing for one touchdown and running for another, the latter with a minute remaining, to give Alabama a 35-28 victory, clinching a playoff spot for the Tide and knocking Georgia out of the playoff. Joining us now is Mark Tracy, who covered the game for the New York Times. Hey, Mark.
Hey.
Before we get to how Hurts is an incredible example for kids out there, let's talk about the game itself. Having watched the national championship game, did you feel like this was literally the exact same script, or were there kind of crucial differences between the two games beyond like quarterback switcheroo thing?
Yeah, no, it was bizarre, the resonances, and we all kind of sensed it a little bit. I remember at one point, you know, Tagovailoa, the really bad injury, the one, I believe, the bad injury that actually caused him to undergo surgery on Sunday, with Saban saying he'll be back in 2 weeks, occurred in the first half. Really, I think on the first drive, you know, he went into the injury tent after the first drive, after he was sacked, which is when the injury, a sprained ankle or an ankle thing ostensibly happened, and then throwing an interception, just his third of the year. So he was struggling, you know, much as Jalen Hurts was struggling in the first half of the championship game in January. Tagovailoa was struggling throughout the first half of the game last Saturday. And, you know, then he comes off the field. It turned out it was because a defensive player had stepped on his foot, and Hurts comes in. And I turned to a colleague in the press box and said, could this really happen? And it really did happen. You know, then Hurts came in and led Alabama to a come-from-behind victory, just as in January. It was remarkable.
Well, the other thing that was similar is that Georgia played really well.
Completely outplayed them.
Georgia outplayed Alabama, and to spin it forward, did not make it into the college football playoffs. They were passed by Oklahoma. Georgia lost twice during the regular season, once to Josh's LSU. They got blown out 36-16. And now to Alabama. You know, playoffs, schmayoffs, it's impossible to sort of really come to a good decision here. But based on what you saw, Mark, and what we all saw, I mean, it looked like they deserve to have another crack at Alabama.
I try not to make prognostications in terms of my personal football interpretations because I don't consider myself an expert in football. I did consider myself an expert in how the College Football Playoff Selection Committee operates because I have covered them for 5 years. And this, to me, was shaping up. And I said this a week ago, after the kind of rivalry week games, I said that if Georgia played Alabama close but lost, it'd be hard to justify dropping them. They did justify it. And, I mean, you know, the committee, they sent out weird tea leaves. You know, they said that among Georgia, which had two losses and was not a conference champion, but obviously looked great, Oklahoma, which was a conference champion and beat Texas in the Big 12 title game, and Ohio State, which also was a one-loss conference champion, albeit one that, you know, did not look as good as even those other two teams throughout the year, I would say, and had the worst loss of the three to Purdue. Last year they said they picked Alabama, which was not a conference champion, over Ohio State, which was, because they determined that Alabama was, quote, unequivocally better than Ohio State. This year they said that of those three teams, none of them were unequivocally better, so then they deferred to kind of protocol they've been given, and one of those is conference championship, so that put Oklahoma above Georgia. But of course, Ohio State was not put above Georgia, which would suggest that they did feel that Georgia and, by extension, Oklahoma were unequivocally better than Ohio State. It seemed a little muddled, and I mean, you know, I do feel like the committee is insulated from political pressures, but certainly one could imagine there being political pressure exerted at least on other people not to lock out three of the five major conference champions, which is what would have happened had Georgia been included.
But aren't these ex post facto explanations, Mark, because it's not like the committee was unanimous that Oklahoma should be in over Georgia, and so then they send out the committee chairman to explain it as if there was some sort of coherent explanation when the different voters might have had different reasons for it. And you said the word deserving Stefan. I mean, nobody deserves nobody deserves anything. I mean, if Georgia had not lost to LSU, and they look like garbage in that game. Right. Like if they had not lost to LSU and they had lost to Alabama in the conference championship game, they would have made it in over Oklahoma and over Ohio State. And so, you know, I think it was Chris Fowler who actually said this, which I found compelling, which was at a certain point, you know, looking good and people thinking you're one of the best teams can only go so far. You have to actually have the results to back that up.
Especially like, with the small sample size that is college football.
Right. Yeah, and they had their chance against Alabama. And if just for the sake of entertainment, I mean, this is all for entertainment, just like put another team in there. Like, that doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily bother me. But it was surprising to me. I think
you're clearly bothered, Mark. Like you're barely keeping it together because you're
bothered,
so angry.
I'm bothered by how wrong I was, and I feel. And obviously, the natural thing to say is, "Well, Mark, you were wrong. Your judgment was poor." But of course, I want to blame the committee for making my judgment look poor. But yes, I was wrong, but not wrong. It's not like I personally think Georgia is better than Oklahoma. I would never claim to have that kind of expertise. I felt that the committee would see things that way.
All right, let's get back to the really important story here, and that is whether Jalen Hurts is a hero for not transferring after he was replaced as the starting quarterback at Alabama. After the game, Kirk Herbstreit tweeted, "And when my voice goes up, that's because he wrote in all caps." What an incredible example for kids out there that think leaving for greener pastures after seeing first sign of adversity is the answer. Exclamation point, exclamation point. Jalen Hurts has shown amazing fortitude all year and has been an amazing leader and supporter of his teammates. And now he saves his team's dreams.
Let's also listen to what Nick Saban had to say about Hurts after the game.
Well, because he's done so much for the program, and it's unprecedented for a guy to win 26 games and then not be the quarterback anymore, and for him to handle that as he has, tremendous character, tremendous class. And then we played him through the year, so if this ever happened, he would have an opportunity, hopefully, to do well, and he certainly took advantage. I told him when he went in today, I said, this is your time, buddy, and he did it.
Do you think that Saban used the word buddy?
Doesn't seem like a buddy guy to me. Does he seem like that to you?
No, he doesn't seem like a buddy guy to me. Well, yeah. Mark, how did you feel about how that conversation played out about Hurts after the game?
I kind of wish we could separate the two parts of it. You know, if you want to praise Hurts for being, you know, a good teammate, you know, he wasn't too vocal about his decision making, but it's certainly conceivable that Jalen Hurts conceived of his decision as being a good teammate, in which case I think it's perfectly appropriate to praise him for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, good for him. I think to then extrapolate it to this is why people shouldn't transfer, you know, no, people should do what they want. I actually did a story about this about a month ago because a surprising number of contenders this year were led by transfers from your Louisiana State Tigers. An Ohio State transfer, Joe Burrow, is the quarterback, to West Virginia with Will Greer, to Michigan with Shea Patterson. You know, there are a lot of prominent transfers.
Oklahoma with Kyler Murray.
I mean, needless to say, I didn't forget him when I wrote the article. I just forgot him in that brief moment. But yes, and Kyler Murray was a transfer, transferred from his father's alma mater of Texas A&M to play at Oklahoma, as Baker Mayfield did. So, you know, especially at quarterback, this has become much more of a trend for a variety of reasons. And actually, it is especially notable, I would argue, that Jalen Hurts did not transfer because of a new rule this year, which permits you to take a redshirt year despite playing in up to four games. So at Clemson, there was a similar situation. A younger quarterback, in this case a freshman named Trevor Lawrence, kind of was in a competition with a senior, Kelly Bryant, for the starting quarterback job. Four games into the season, Dabo Swinney, Clemson's coach, announced that Lawrence, the freshman, would be the starter, and Kelly Bryant elected to transfer. And so basically Kelly Bryant didn't play any more this season, and despite playing substantial snaps in Clemson's first four games, he will be able to treat this season as his redshirt year. And you know, he'll be able to transfer to wherever he can transfer to next year and play one more season of college eligibility. Jalen Hurts, you know, has not used a redshirt year. He started as a true freshman. So he theoretically could have, after four games, when it was quite apparent that Tua was the starter, he could have said, you know what, I'm taking this as my redshirt year and I'm going to transfer and go to a place where I can start, which probably isn't Alabama because Tua is younger than I am, and he didn't. So I don't think it's unfair to read stuff into that decision, although we don't know exactly. Maybe it's possible that Jalen Hurts wouldn't be the starter elsewhere because he kind of can only operate in a unique offense. Maybe he'd be forced to change positions. We don't know. It is significant to me that he didn't transfer. I just don't think it's a broader lesson for everyone. It's a lesson for him.
I would even go further and say that I think Herb Street's tweet is correct. I think that it is actually a good lesson to children. If you're not going to get it, I don't know, Mark, if you've like thought about like what is the appropriate age at which to tell your children about the NCAA, but gather around, Johnny and Sally, and let me tell you about amateurism. But if Herb Street's tweet literally is, what an incredible example for kids out there that think leaving for greener pastures after seeing first a sign of adversity is the answer. And I think you could tell a kid, like, look, you got you aren't the starter on your fifth grade team anymore, but you should still be a good teammate. And look what happened with Alabama and the guy got a chance again. Like, that is a really good lesson for kids. And I think the actual real life implications of the NCAA and what it means is actually kind of a pretty specific case in which that general rule does not apply.
Right, because of what Arian Foster tweeted in response to Herb Street, which was, don't shame other kids for recognizing this system is exploiting them, and they have a small opportunity to put film out there for the next level. You're branding business decisions as character flaws. So I think to not bring up the idea and make it clear, even to your children, that the NCAA is a harmful and exploitative and unfair cartel is wrong. And I think we need to point that out.
Daddy, what's a cartel?
Opportunity. We can, that's what dictionaries are for. I have a counter argument.
Love it.
For why Jalen Hurts may have wanted to stay at Alabama, that has nothing to do
with
his great teammateness, which is that he didn't have to get hurt for a year. If Jalen Hurts is a good enough
athlete. That's like his brand, though.
If Jalen Hurts is a good enough athlete to play in the NFL, and I really don't know if he is, and I don't know what position he would be good enough to play in the NFL, but if he is NFL caliber good.
It's plausible that he is.
He doesn't need to play at Alabama.
Right.
It might be better for him to not play now to maximize his health.
This is the galaxy brain take.
That is where I am. I'm not suggesting that's what they did.
Because at running back, this is typical, right? Georgia last year had two different running backs go in the draft, I think, right? There was Chubb and someone else. I mean, at running back, you take one third of the touches. Right, that's right. And, you put plenty of tape out there. You decrease your mileage, which lets teams be more comfortable drafting you and makes it more likely that you'll get to that second contract in the NFL, which is where you make the real money.
And
the
problem is quarterback
doesn't work that way.
Well, but who's saying he's going to be a quarterback? But even if he is a quarterback, he's got some pretty good tape out there. He won 26 out of 28
this
games.
This is a horrible take.
He's not a great NFL caliber quarterback, right? But
probably
he might be. And athletically, one guy got hurt on Saturday, and that was Tua. And he has to have surgery. Jalen Hurts does not have to have surgery this year.
No, Jalen Hurts actually literally did have surgery this year because he hurt his ankle.
He was injured.
Oh, he was.
And he did.
I think
a similar kind of surgery. They have Dr. Andrews down there. He does their
ever-present Dr. Andrews without having to play again. So,
well, here's the reason that your take is wrong. I respect the take game.
It's a take.
I respect the take game.
I didn't say it was right.
But he looked really good in coming on in relief. And I think we kind of glossed over that a little bit. And he looked better than he did in the national championship game. He was throwing the ball on the run with authority in ways that
touchdown was a fantastic play.
In ways that he didn't consistently in his first
two
years.
This is consistent with my argument because you could say that he didn't play this year. He didn't get hurt this year. He comes on in
absolute...
He did get hurt this year, but he didn't play this year. He comes on at absolutely the biggest moment of the season and plays really, really well. Do we need more information? He can play well.
He's not a great quarterback. Okay. All right. last topic in the segment is going to be Tua's interview with Tom Rinaldi on ESPN, in which they had this exchange.
It had to do with a lot of pressure. If I don't perform well, perform the way I'm supposed to, I'm going to get it after.
When you say I'm going to get it, just be clear what you mean there, Tua.
After. Oh. Well, just know that the belt was involved and other things were involved as well. And it's almost the same with school. You know, if I don't get this grade, I don't get this grade, I'm going to have to suffer the consequences.
First, was the music playing when they did the interview? That's
Tom,
what I want to know.
Tom Rinaldi was playing the ukulele.
Yeah, he was sitting there with his...
Like strumming the guitar there. Tom Rinaldi did not really follow up on that revelation in this interview. And that, to me, was problematic. His mother later said in the interview, described his father's treatment of Tua as the Bible or the belt. This is fucked up. And I know that there are corners of our society that believe that disciplining your children by hitting them is okay.
Yeah, this obviously came up with Adrian Peterson from the other direction with a football player beating his child. But the commentary about this when the interview came out, I think it was like Chris Brown, smart football guy on Twitter, is like, wait a second. Did Tua just talk about his father beating him? It just came kind of out of nowhere in the middle of this piece and was unremarked upon really in the story. And then it's just like over. It was right. Just a very odd thing to have been mentioned matter-of-factly and not to have been the subject of its own narrative.
And the father didn't shy away from it either. I was tough. He could go 15-15 with four touchdowns, but when he throws a pick, it's the worst game.
Not how I aspire to be a father eventually, but yeah.
I mean, the thing that is also a parallel with Peterson is the idea that it quote unquote worked because Tua is now a good quarterback and I presume a good student.
Oh, but people make that argument all the time.
But with it, and Adrian Peterson too. Adrian Peterson too, that he said the reason that I discipline my children in this way is because it was done to me and look, I turned out well. And so that, I think, is the error in logic.
Well, and the television part of it only got worse. Awful Announcing did a piece deconstructing it. And Desmond Howard on College Game Day said, I saw that his dad was like the Hawaiian version of Joe Jackson. There's no way Alabama's going to lose that game because out comes that belt. People on the set laughed. Not everybody. But I think...
I mean, if we wanted to make this into a broader thing, right, like there's still, you know, Desmond Howard is someone within football culture, right? Tua Tagovailoa and his father are people within football culture. Arguably, the three of us are not, at least in the same way. Although, Stefan, it's actually, I'd be curious to know if you consider yourself within football culture. But we're seeing this differently, to say the very least. And, you know, I'm not trying to be morally relativist about it. I think that hitting children is wrong, and I don't think, you know, that makes me just culturally different. I think it's wrong. But empirically, there clearly is this culture in football in which, you know, this kind of discipline, this kind of not just discipline in terms of hitting people, but discipline in terms of like being extremely harsh and demanding in this way is kind of, for football performance, for something as seemingly mundane as football performance, is seen as acceptable and even laudable.
Mark Tracy writes about college football for the New York Times. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Almost 14 months after losing to Trinidad and Tobago and failing to qualify for the 2018 World Cup finals, the U.S. men's national soccer team finally has a new coach. He is Greg Berhalter. He's 45. He's American. He played in the Netherlands, Germany, England, and Major League Soccer and for the national team. And he's coached in Sweden and MLS until last week for the Columbus Crew. Berhalter could wind up being the answer for the American men, but for now, he's mostly the result of what our next guest, Grant Wall, called in Sports Illustrated a ham-handed process that has piled tons of unnecessary pressure on the new coach. Hey, Grant.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Let's talk first about the ham-handed process. The last coach, the ill-fated Bruce Arena, resigned 3 days after the Trinidad loss on October 13th, 2017. The U.S. Soccer Federation picked a new president in February. He took 6 months to hire a general manager, Ernie Stewart, who was charged with hiring the new coach. What the hell happened here? Why did this take so long?
Well, it's kind of crazy when you think about it. U.S. Soccer really dragged their feet on the process of hiring a general manager. And I know that this was an institutional change. The position of general manager was created so that a soccer expert would do the hiring of the new national team coach, as opposed to the past when it was the president of the federation, who typically has not been a soccer expert. So I understand that, but once Carlos Cordero was elected president of U.S. Soccer in February, it took 6 months before Ernie Stewart took over as GM on August 1st. He then began the process of searching for a coach, but it really seems like he only did two, maybe three formal interviews before landing on Greg Berhalter. And my sense is with Greg Berhalter is he may end up being a good choice, but he's certainly not the only choice, which is kind of what U.S. Soccer has made it look like with this process.
Stewart has this really bizarre philosophy that you articulated in your piece, which is, I'm only going to interview someone. He just puts like so much weight on the concept of the interview. Like, I'm only going to interview someone if essentially I believe that they are the right person for the job. He has his list. He had a list of 30-something people. He had his criteria of what he wanted a coach to be. And then he just winnowed that list down without actually speaking to any of these individuals, which if you've ever done any hiring in your life, a lot of us have, I just have never heard of a hiring process for any position in any field that proceeds in that way.
Neither have I. And so I'm dumbfounded by that process. I look at it as, if you're going to be hiring for an important position, you need to gain as much information as possible to make that decision. Now, Ernie Stewart says he used data analytics to look into the potential coaches, and that's great. That's more information. But to not sit down and do a formal interview with, what, half a dozen, 8, 10 different potential candidates?
They certainly have the time.
Well, that's the other thing, too. The U.S. Soccer has wasted a year.
Yep.
And maybe the one silver lining of failing to qualify for World Cup 2018 was, well, at least you can get a head start on the next four-year cycle, the new coach can. And now the U.S. finds itself behind the other countries in the world who even competed in the World Cup because this year has been wasted hiring a coach who would have taken the job a year ago, probably. And so that is very frustrating for U.S. soccer fans.
And it wasn't as if there was a shortage of really interesting and accomplished potential candidates here. Tata Martino, Juan Carlos Osorio, who coached in Mexico, Tab Ramos from within the U.S. Federation, Julen Lopetegui, who coached Spain for 2 years and contacted U.S. Soccer, you reported, saying that he was interested, but the Federation told him they were too far along in their process. This is just bizarre. And I understand, on the one hand, coming out of the last two coaching cycles, that that there's a sense of we want to retrench and get a solid American who hasn't been a retread in here to sort of craft that American style. I mean, I think the U.S. Federation and, you know, fans probably feel burned a little bit for what's gone on for the last 6 years. But that doesn't seem to really explain why you would overlook or ignore potential foreign candidates for this job.
Correct. And, you know, I did report that Julian Lopetegui contacted U.S. soccer expressing interest in the U.S. job. This guy was unbeaten for 2 years with Spain. Spain! And could not get an interview, even though he was interested. In my opinion, you're never too far along in a process until you announce the coach. So that's mystifying as well. Other candidates inside the U.S. Included Peter Vermees, Bob Bradley, Jesse Marsh, guys who had very good qualifications potentially for this U.S. job. They weren't interviewed either. And so you're left really scratching your head about why U.S. soccer would go through a process that basically is saying Greg Berhalter is the only serious candidate and is so remarkable that we're not even going to interview these other guys. And that's also a problem because Jay Berhalter is one of the most powerful people in U.S. soccer.
His brother.
Greg Berhalter's brother.
So this is the conflict of interest part that also plays a role here.
And U.S. soccer has taken great pains and gone into contortions to say that Jay Berhalter was not involved in the hiring process of Greg Berhalter. And that may be the case, but Jay Berhalter was deeply involved in the process of hiring Ernie Stewart, the GM who hired Greg Berhalter. And I'm not saying the fix is in here. What I am saying is that U.S. soccer should have been well aware that if they made it seem like Greg Berhalter was the only serious candidate here, that would look bad considering his brother is such a powerful figure inside U.S. soccer.
So you said in your piece, Grant, that Christian Pulisic said recently that all he wanted was a guy with a real plan that that shows kind of where we are with this search. And, you know, you can say a lot of things about Greg Berhalter, but based on what I've read and what you reported, he's definitely a guy with a real plan. This is somebody who has a system that he's developed in MLS with the Columbus Crew. He's known as someone who has an ability to put together an organized team and to put together a team that maybe is better than the sum of its parts. And that all sounds good, right?
Yeah, and potentially it could be a return to sort of what has made the U.S. men's team good when they've been pretty good. And, you know, I'm talking about 2014 World Cup, 2010 World Cup, 2002, when they were greater than the sum of their parts, when they had an identity that was recognizable, when they had players who were hard to play against, and that was the reputation of the U.S. team. And obviously you want to have some skill players too. And I would look back at that 2002 World Cup quarterfinalists, and there were some skill players on that team, like Claudio Reyna, John O'Brien, Ernie Stewart even. And I think it's possible to build around Christian Pulisic, who's still just 20 years old, and several other young rising players, most of them playing the German Bundesliga for the U.S., and do some good things and restore some pride in the U.S. men's national team.
So what are the top lines on what the Berhalter system is?
Well, he's possession-based, and that is something that should be a good thing, especially against CONCACAF teams. It remains to be seen if the U.S. will be able to play possession soccer against world heavyweights. That's always been a big issue for the U.S. He also has teams that, if you watched his teams in Columbus, he's very much about using the full width of the field, sending the fullbacks wide downfield, and really getting them involved in the attack. And he's built around kind of a number 10. Federico Higuain in Columbus is that guy he's built around. And I'm curious to see how he uses Pulisic, because he's been more typically a wide player, but he's capable of playing a number 10 position. So that's going to be, I think, a question for Greg Berhalter this week as he does the media rounds in New York. Where do you see Christian Pulisic?
it's a really amorphous process being a national team coach in soccer. The team doesn't play together regularly. When it does get together, it's for short bursts and then games. How do you view the coach's job to craft this style and transmit it to players? What coaches on a world level of national teams are successful? Like, what are their strategies for taking these players who play for different systems in different countries at different levels and integrating them for these moments to prepare for these big international events?
Well, I think the most successful national team coaches, players know what to expect coming in terms of an approach to training sessions, in terms of an approach to formations in games, how the team is going to play in games. The roles of each player are well explained to them. I mean, Jurgen Klinsmann really did not ever explain the roles of a player to him. He just sort of wanted them to figure it out. And that was a huge issue with the Klinsmann era in right. U.S. soccer. And I think Greg Berhalter is a very organized coach, and I think he definitely will communicate to players what is expected of them individually and as a team. And you want players to look forward to coming into the national team. And Michael Parkhurst with Atlanta said this week in an interview with ESPN that it had gotten to a point where U.S. players weren't looking forward to coming into play for the national team. And that's a really significant indictment of what things had become under the U.S. soccer system over the last few years. So there's a lot of challenges here for Greg Berhalter, but I think he's a guy who's not going to waste time, the very limited time that he has with his players. He understands, having played for the national team in two World Cups, that you only get so much time as a national team coach, and that is by far the biggest difference compared to a club coach.
I see a little bit of conflict here in terms of the style questions, and I'm hoping you can help me sort it out. The first is that playing a possession-based style, as you indicated, especially going up against countries that are more talented, seems extremely aspirational, right? Especially at this stage of U.S. soccer, the notion that the U.S. is going to play against a Spain or a Germany or even an England based on the pretty terrible friendly results from recently, and the U.S. is just going to hold on to the ball and be kind of able to control the game in that way against these countries. Like, that seems like something that's down the road. On the other hand, you're hiring a coach in Berhalter who, with Columbus, took a team that didn't have the most talent in MLS and that didn't spend a lot of money and that was able to make the playoffs 4 out of 5 years, make the MLS Cup final 1 year. And so then you could look at that and say, oh, well, maybe that there's a sense of realism there. The idea that the U.S. isn't going to have the most talent, and let's get a guy who can have a team punch above its weight. Do you see there being a conflict there? And if so, how would you kind of resolve that?
I think more than likely, when Greg Berhalter's U.S. national team plays against the big teams in world soccer, you're not going to see a ton of possession. I think Jurgen Klinsmann had this pie-in-the-sky view that the U.S. would play that way. I do think Berhalter would be more pragmatic. And you're only as good as your players are, right? And so, you know, you have a guy like Pulisic, who's definitely a really talented, creative player to build around. And you have some exciting young players coming up. But they're not in a position, you know, a lot of these guys played against England recently and couldn't do much of anything in that game against an England B team. And so this is going to be a long process. And national team coaches, in my opinion, they aren't responsible for the skills of their players. They just see these guys every once in a while. Their job is to put together the best possible team with the parts that they have. And I do think Greg Berhalter will try and maximize that. I do think the U.S. will return to some of the identity that has made them good when they have been good. But I look back at that 2002 team that Berhalter was on for the U.S. at that World Cup, and they actually played some good soccer. If you remember that game against Portugal, the 3-2 win that really got things going for the U.S. in that tournament, there were some well-constructed goals by the U.S. in that game and in other games in that tournament. And so that may come with having a few skilled players in the right positions, but also having the confidence that comes from being really well organized, that you can actually create something out of that too.
Yeah, that's going to be 20 years ago when we hit the next World Cup, Grant. So the fact that we're still talking about that now as the moments of great U.S. soccer is a little sad. There have been some good times in between, though. Grant Wall covers soccer for Sports Illustrated and Fox Sports and is the author of Masters of Modern Soccer, How the World's Best Play the 21st Century Game. Grant, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And now it is time for After Balls. Josh, big world record set over the weekend in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
The teddy bear toss.
Okay.
Hershey Bears ice hockey team, affiliate of the Washington Capitals, the Stanley Cup champion, Washington Capitals. They beat the record formerly held by the Calgary Hitmen of 28,815 teddy bears thrown onto the ice. During a game, 34,798. Let's listen to the scene in Hershey.
The Bears will look to tie it as Binghamton has the lead, but a Funk's Restaurant power play for Hershey. Manga the point for Nash. Left wing side, Scarbosa snaps a shot, hit the crossbar. Rebound, Barber, he scores! It's Teddy Bear toss time! Riley Barber scores the goal, and the fans are letting them fly. It's raining stuffed animals in Chocolate Town.
It's raining stuffed animals in chocolate. That's a great call.
That sounds like a good euphemism for
something
really gross.
Did you know the teddy bear toss was a thing?
I did know that it was a thing, yes.
I didn't really know it was a thing.
Yeah.
It started in 1993, according to the Teddy Bear Toss wiki page.
What was it? Raining teddy bears in Chocolate Town?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Kamloops Blazers.
I had something that didn't agree with me last night. It's raining teddy bears in Chocolate Town.
Kamloops Blazers started it. Marketing genius Don Larson in 1993. It's for charity.
Love charity. Stefan, what is your teddy bear toss?
Well, last week in Mauritius, the Intergovernmental Committee for the Safeguarding of the Intangible Cultural Heritage of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, inscribed, its word, 31 elements, its word, on its representative list of the Intangible Cultural Heritage of Humanity. The list consists of a range of arts and traditions and other cultural activities that UNESCO feels are worthy of recognizing and preserving against the march of time. This year's editions included the picking of Iva grass on Ozren Mountain in Bosnia and Herzegovina. That takes place on September 11th, which is, of course, the day of the beheading of St. John the Baptist. Reggae music of Jamaica, the traditional spring festive rites of the Kazakh horse breeders, traditional string puppet drama of Sri Lanka, the Muba dance of the Lenje ethnic group of Central Province in Zambia, and avalanche risk management in Switzerland and Austria. But there are sports on the list, too. So a big UNESCO welcome to hurling, the cool Irish sport that's like field hockey, but you hit the ball in the air with a stick. From the two Koreas, we've got some wrestling. Sasirum in the north, in which, quote, two opponents try to push each other to the ground using a satpa, a fabric strap connecting the waist and leg, their torso, hands, and legs. Winner gets a bull. And the slightly but critically different Sasirium from the south, in which two players wearing long fabric belts around their waists and one thigh grip their opponent's belt and deploy various techniques to send them to the ground. The winner there gets an ox. Big difference. More traditional wrestling from Georgia, the country, not the state, called Chidoba. It's got some brightly colored vests, around 200 different holds and counter holds. The practice encourages a healthy lifestyle and plays an important role in intercultural dialogue, UNESCO says. I watched the 10-minute video for Chidoba I learned that Chidobe has elements of judo. It's common at feasts. It bridges ethnic and religious rivalries. One coach notes in the video that because wrestling stops when one wrestler's knee touches the ground, Chidobe has a chivalrous essence. As the ancestors used to say, Josh, even a dog won't bite a man who has fallen down. I would dispute that, because I think a dog would bite a man that's fallen down. So I kept looking for my favorite UNESCO-sanctioned intangible cultural heritage-worthy sport. Good point. 2017 was kind of a dud year for sports. 2016 added tatid, an Indian martial art that's like choreographed stick fighting. Not enough competition for me. 2015, including some tugging rituals and games from Southeast Asia. But again, quote, intentionally uncompetitive to promote the well-being of the community, blah, blah, blah. But I hit pay dirt in 2014. Mongolian knuckle bone shooting. I'm going to read from the UNESCO description now. Teams of 6 to 8 players flick 30 domino-like marble tablets on a smooth wooden surface toward a target of sheep knuckle bones, aiming to knock them into a target zone while shooters sing traditional knuckle bone shooting melodies and songs. Mongolian knuckle bone shooting is awesome. The playing pieces are literally made from the knuckle bones, as you might have guessed, of sheep and goats and deer horns. Some ankle bones are involved too. You flick from a distance of 9 elbows, or 4.72 meters. There are tournaments, up to 600 knuckle bone shooters. There's a national finals in the central stadium in the capital, Ulaanbaatar. And there's some excellent knuckle bone equipment, handcrafted, the shooting target, the shooting domino, the shooting rack, a special chair, and this.
And ninth is Havchar Hai, which is designed for the elderly shooters to enhance their sight and accuracy as well as increase the power or the force applied to the shooting.
I love that the olds get a special shooter. It looks like a bow and arrow mechanism kind of thing. But what's really awesome about Mongolian knuckle bone shooting is, as you may have just deduced, the singing and chanting. There are different songs for different techniques and different parts of the game. Lyrics include lines like, "Hail your friend hits the target," which seems much better than "na na na na, hey, 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 goodbye," or "we will rock you," or "defense," or "Boston sucks." Well, maybe not "Boston sucks." Anyway, here's one more clip. Listen for the flick, the knuckle bones toppling, and the sheer joy and respect for the shooter. Mongolian knuckle bone shooting. It's knuckle bone-tastic. Josh, what's your teddy bear toss?
I would like to hear the Hank Williams Jr. version of the Monday Night Knuckle Bone Night Shooting.
Knuckle Bone Shooting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All my, et cetera. Okay. Quarterback play in the NFL this year is good, but what this after ball presupposes is, what if it was bad?
Some of it's bad.
True. But what if it was really bad?
Okay.
Chase Stewart of the website Football Perspective wrote a post over the summer in which he identified the worst passing seasons in NFL history. The winner, meaning the biggest loser, was the 1943 performance by one Ronnie Cahill. That year, Cahill threw 3 touchdowns and 21 interceptions for the Chicago Cardinals. Cahill was a high school legend in Central Massachusetts, which I think a lot of people overlook when they talk about Ronnie Cahill's football career. You can't forget the fact that he led Lemonster to an undefeated year in 1932, in which they outscored their opponents 442-31.
Good season.
He also led Holy Cross to a 23-3-2 record, and he completed his first 11 passes in leading a college all-star team over the New York Giants in 1940.
They should really bring that game back.
They used to do those sort of things. Yeah. So 1943, during World War II, he was a replacement for the Cardinals' starting quarterback, a guy named Bud Schwenk, who was a solid signal caller. Cahill's NFL career, not that good. Decidedly less spectacular than these schwank years. In an article posted on the website profootballresearchers.org, Mark Speck wrote that Cahill's 1943 Chicago Cardinals were one of the dozen worst teams in league history. Head coach Jimmy Konzelman left to take care of his baseball duties, and the woeful Cards had replacement Phil Handler wishing he had taken up another sport. At times in 1943, it seemed some of the Cards were playing something other than football. Chicago was hit hard by the war as both their top passer and receiver marched off to the front. Rookie quarterback Ronnie Cahill tossed a league-high 21 interceptions. The defense gave up 238 points, most of the NFL, while the offense scored only 95. The Cardinals almost won a game. They lost 13-7 to Washington. And according to this article, Chicago had so many problems, they had to merge with Pittsburgh in 1944. Team so bad, it ceased to exist. They also lost all of their games in 1944. The interesting thing that I discovered in doing a little bit of research on Cahill was that as of October 7th, 1943, he was leading the league in completion percentage. Wasn't a very good completion percentage, but it wasn't very easy to pass the ball back in those days. 19 of 36 for a 528 percentage. But then a newspaper in his home state of Massachusetts in the town of Pittsfield reported as of December, 2 months later, Cahill had gone to the hospital and may have pneumonia. He was run down physically and in need of a rest. A few months after that, in March 1944, Cahill was working at a war plant in his hometown of Leominster. He was called up to the army the next month. There isn't that much written about this guy on the internet. I did find a piece in the Sentinel and Enterprise newspaper published in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, in which a local historian noted that Cahill, he died in 1992 and that he was, quote, not one to toot his own horn, perhaps for understandable reasons. He was kind of nonchalant with what he had accomplished. He was never one to fill in all the details when talking about what he had done. Three touchdowns and nothing else. That's pretty much all you need to know about Ronnie Cahill and the 1943 Chicago football Cardinals. That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. We would also love your calls for our call-in show, 77-HANG-UP-10, 77-HANG-UP-10. Give us a call. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.